Let me just check to make sure that I guess everything is working. Okay. Well, let's begin by indicating that today is March 29th, 2007, and this is Jim Boning talking to Dr. Alan Debus at his home in Deerfield, Illinois. I know you were born on the 16th of August in 1926. Could you tell me just a little bit about your parents and your and you were born here in Chicago, too?
I was born in Chicago, yes, and brought up in the northern suburbs. My father was in the set-up paper box business. He had a factory on the north side of Chicago, Modern Boxes. And my grandfather had also been in the set-up paper box business. And we lived in Evanston when I was brought up, moved to Glenview. And my parents moved to Northfield, which is just a little bit south of here. And what else would you like to know?
Do you have any siblings?
No.
You were an only child.
Mm-hmm.
And where did you get your early schooling?
Well, in Evanston.
Okay.
At the Orrington School for Grammar School, and then Evanston High School. And I graduated from high school in 1944, and I had a scholarship to go to an engineering school in southern Indiana. And I thought, well, I'll be in the Army in a matter of weeks, so I'd rather stay at home. And I made a last-minute application to engineering at Northwestern and was accepted right away and went right into college.
Was that school Rose Holman? What was the engineering school in southern Indiana?
I think that was it.
Rose Holman in Terre Haute.
That sounds right. I really don't remember exactly. I had something like Rensselaer in my mind, but that's in New York.
Right.
Yeah, you know, that sounds like it.
Rose Holman was a fine engineering school, and it was in Terre Haute, which is in the southern part of the state.
Yeah.
When you were in high school, did you have any teachers who had an influence on you, or anyone else who had an influence on you?
Yeah, I had two teachers. One of them was Emma Rogers. I took, I think, 2 years of courses from her, American history and world history. And also Mr. Anderson, who taught chemistry. Both of them were excellent teachers. I should add a third one, too. Oh, heavens, what was his name? Well, I don't remember. There was an older gentleman who taught modern European history. I took my senior year. And the name will come to me later, probably. But I don't remember right now.
And what attracted you to engineering?
Well, it was chemical engineering.
Okay.
That attracted me. But also the fact that this was wartime, and this was a practical area, and something where I could do some good. I really didn't want to go into business because I never felt that I was a businessman in the sense that my father and grandfather were. And for this reason, I thought that combining engineering with chemistry made a great deal of sense, especially at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And now in time, I moved out of that. I don't know if you want me to go on with this.
Oh, yes. No, that's fine.
But The one thing I really disliked about engineering at Northwestern was the fact that it was a condensed program, not necessarily because of the war, although that might have been part of it, because somehow I felt that engineering was sort of like medical school. You had an awful lot to take and just a limited amount of time. And it was, I think I was into the end of my sophomore, even the beginning of my junior year, that I had an elective. And I took a course in history from someone who was very influential on me also, John Murray, who taught Renaissance and Reformation history. And he was really a great teacher. And John really got me interested in what he was teaching. I wish I could say every teacher I've had. but he did.
Was there any reason why you selected that particular course? When
it was about the only one that was available out of
history. Okay. Because for an engineer to take a Renaissance history course is sort of as an elective.
Although I had an interest in early history anyway.
Okay.
I remember once in high school, we had an English teacher who wanted all the students to talk on something as part of an assignment. And I decided to talk on the history of ancient Egypt. And I took up the whole hour, and I think I bored everyone to death.
So you escaped the draft. You were not drafted.
I was not drafted, no. I was, that was another strange thing. I was continually being reclassified. At one time, I was 4F. I think at the end, I was 4L. It's because of my eyesight. But another time I was 1AL, another time I was 4AL. I don't know what 4AL is. I never knew another person who had that. But yeah, I escaped it. I got through Northwestern. I went every quarter and was out in 3 years. At the end of that time, John Murray took a position at Indiana University, and he offered me an assistantship. So I went down there.
And at this point, you were moving out of engineering.
Well, as a matter of fact, I had moved from chemical engineering to a chemistry major.
Oh, okay.
So my Northwestern degree is in chemistry.
In chemistry, okay.
It's a B.S. in chemistry, and I had almost a second major in history by the time I graduated. So I was really moving towards the history of chemistry, although I didn't know it.
Well, that's what I would like to get into, how you made that move from a chemistry major, and I think you worked at Abbott Laboratories as a chemist, is that correct?
Yeah, well, that's quite a bit later.
Okay. I'm intrigued about how all this fits together. Why don't you just take us through it?
All right. I was John Murray's assistant at Indiana in the fall of 1947. And he was a very good teacher, especially in seminars. And we would try to choose topics that made sense, and he gave a seminar in Tudor history 1 year and in Stuart history another year. Oh, there's a deer out there. Oh no, it's a little girl. We see deer. Sorry, every time I see something move, I think it's a deer.
We got deer in the backyard all the time. They eat my flowers.
Anyway, when I was getting ready to prepare my master's thesis, he said, Now, don't be foolish. Don't write another thesis on Tudor political history or something like that. You're a chemist. So do something on chemistry in the period we were dealing with. And he said, here, there's a journal, Isis. Take a look at that. So I started looking at Isis. And in the end, I wrote a thesis on Robert Boyle. And by that time, I was into the history of science, really.
Did Indiana have a history of science program?
No. No, it was really no field whatsoever. Indiana did get into the history of science. First, I think, by inviting George Sarton to give a series of lectures there on Renaissance history. But that was after my time. It was one of the last things he did. And then, of course, a little after that, Marie Boas and Rupert Hall went there again. I didn't know them. It was after my time. Anyway, I graduated, was out of money. My parents, I don't think they wanted to support me anymore. I went to work for my father for a year, selling boxes. And then I went back to get a master's degree in chemistry. And that's where I met my wife.
Oh, are you a chemist?
Yes.
Okay. And you went back to Northwestern?
No, Indiana.
You were still at Indiana?
Yeah.
Okay.
Went back to Indiana. And, we were both, towards the end of getting our master's degrees in chemistry, I had one more course to take, I think, to finish the coursework. And we decided to get married. So we got married in in August 1951, and got married in Miami. Her parents came from San Juan, and mine came from Chicago. And for a honeymoon, we drove back to Chicago. I had $200. See, money went a lot further then. Anyway, we didn't have a job or anything, any prospects of a job.
And neither of you got a degree then, or did you get your degree?
No, I didn't finish it.
So neither of you finished your degree?
No, I had my master's degree in history.
History, but you didn't finish the degree in chemistry.
No. After we got back to Chicago, we started looking for jobs in the newspaper. And we checked out several places, and finally, one of them was Abbott Laboratories in North Chicago, and it was a job for a woman. That's how you did it, wasn't it? Or did I go in first?
You went to interview.
I went first, or you went first?
You went first.
I went first. They said they wanted a woman. So she went, she got the job, and she told them that I needed a job too, and there was a job available over in development, and I took that, so we both got jobs there, and I worked in research and development for 5 years.
Where was your job?
Microanalytical chemist. Our division was in charge making sure that the new products that the other chemists brought were such carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, using a nice microanalytical balance, little platinum, ditches and to not, so to make sure that the new drugs were where they're supposed to be. And from there, then it went to Alan's part to if there were approved for him to get new methods of making them.
5 years, was history still in the back of your mind all of this time?
No, not at first. Although I always had an interest in it, and I belonged to they had a history club that had the laboratories. I went to that, and I spoke there. We started in 51, and by 53, I was getting a bit tired. It seemed as though, unless you had a PhD in chemistry, you would always just be handed down somebody else's project to work on. And that was all right. I got a couple of patents out of my work, but still, you didn't initiate anything.
Novocaine, new production of Novocaine products.
That was a good one. Then again, you do that and you only get a dollar.
That's true.
Anyway, in 53, we thought maybe we should go back and get a PhD. I was interested in the history of science. Had been all along, more or less. And went up to Madison and spoke to Marshall Claggett. In fact, I was introduced to all of the members of the department there. And it looked interesting, but the living conditions for graduate students in Madison at that time were really not very good. You had to go out in the town and have oil heating stoves and all, and we thought this was just a bit too hard to deal with, and so we went back and bought a new Buick.
That was in 53,
yeah.
You said?
Yeah.
Okay.
You had a baby by then, too?
Yeah, no, afterwards. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had a Buick and a baby. we continued at Abbott Laboratories. Rooney stopped working after the baby was born. It just seemed as though it was pretty difficult to get anywhere. I had a good friend who was, Southern was his name, head of the library at the laboratories. He offered to take me and put me in the library, but even that wasn't really what I wanted. So we finally started looking at history of science programs. There were only three to speak of at the time. Bernard Cohen was at Harvard, and Marshall Claggett was at Wisconsin, and Henry Gerlach was at Cornell. Mm. None of them were really interested in exactly what I wanted to do, which is certainly not too surprising. We finally decided on Harvard. I was admitted to all of the programs, so we just sort of packed up and left.
And you were working as a physical chemist with a professor.
Well, you mean at Harvard? Mm-hmm. I got an assistantship after I got there, but that was the year after I started.
So what did you do for financial support with the baby?
Well, my grandfather had died, he left some money, and we were able to get started there. later on, my parents helped somewhat. And of course, the money you got in fellowships in those days, very, very little. I don't remember how much it was at Harvard, but I do remember that when I was John Murray's assistant at Indiana, it was $600 for the year.
The year, wow.
So it really wasn't enough to take you anywhere. Of course, the tuition and cost of living was much, much less than it is today.
So that was 56 that you went to Harvard?
Yeah.
And who did you work for then? Did you find someone to mentor what you wanted to do?
No.
Okay.
Only in a roundabout way, but not at Harvard. Technically, the my dissertation advisor, chief, whatever, was Bernard Cohen. There were hardly any people there, and you more or less had to choose your own topic and do it largely on your own. I had three fields when I had my oral examination. That was history of science, and Tudor Stuart history, and medieval history. And I thought it was interesting, the orals were held at the house of Wilbur K. Jordan, who was the president of Radcliffe University, and he was on the Harvard History Department program. But there really was no one who was doing history of chemistry. Leonard K. Nash of the chemistry department mm-hmm. had an interest in the field, but his interests were really more in the philosophy of science than the history of chemistry. Awfully nice fellow. He's still alive, I believe.
Is he really?
I think so.
No. What about Conant? Did you interact?
Conant was no longer involved in the program.
Okay.
And in fact, I don't remember seeing him once on the Harvard campus.
So this was all done within the history department.
Well, no, the history of science was sort of a semi-autonomous unit. And Cohen was in charge of me, although I didn't see him very often. I always liked Cohen, but he was kind of aloof. And I don't think he really wanted to be bothered an awful lot by the students, especially students who weren't working in an area close to his own interests. I hope I'm not doing him an injustice, but
I like him and his wife.
I like him too.
They used to have, and they have seminars, invite the wives.
Oh, okay.
And his wife was very nice because when I had a baby, told me where to take him to the doctors. She was very helpful, very nice person.
But when Cohen was working in his office in Widener 189, he really didn't want to be bothered. So you didn't bother him. Or if you did, you could get in.
Well, I was going to ask you what kind of a person he was, but I think you've just told me. So, what about coursework? Was there any coursework, and were there courses in the history of science?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Cohen gave a one-year survey of the history of science, which I think was very useful and very influential, probably. He wrote a short history of physics and scientific revolution or something. It's a nice little paperback that I think was the basis of his lectures. But in addition to that, each year he gave a two-semester seminar in the history of physics, primarily. He was very interested in motion, Galileo, and of course Isaac Newton.
Your oral, though, sounds like a tour de force, if you had those three areas in which you were, I suppose, going to be quizzed. Was your panel mostly historians?
Two historians, and of course Cohen was there, that's three. And I think that Leonard Nash was there also.
Okay.
Taylor was the medievalist. I had taken his course in medieval intellectual history.
And what was your thesis on?
The thesis was on the English Paracelsians.
Okay, which was your first book?
Yes.
Okay. Had you pretty well thought out by this time what your career was going to be and what you were going to pursue?
Well, I was very much interested in the Paracelsians, and when I was doing research, the preliminary research on the dissertation, I ran into a 1935 multi-part article by Walter Pago. What's the exact title? I don't even remember the exact title, but it dealt with the background to biology in the 17th century, and he took up all of these people that I had not seen much of before and were never mentioned in other courses or books, mostly the more mystical figures of the period, and I became very interested in Robert Fludd, for instance. I had been interested in Paracelsus earlier, but Pavel's work was especially interesting to me. And there was this opportunity to apply for what was a Social Science Research Council, Fulbright, various things. I applied for a number of scholarships, and I don't think you were too happy about it at the beginning. But you know, in the 50s, students weren't commonly going off to Europe to study. And of course we were married and had a baby. In fact, by the time we went, we had two. And that wasn't very usual either. So anyway, I applied, and I got the Fulbright, and then I got a supplementary one, I think, from a Social Science Research Council. And we went to England. Before leaving, I wrote Walter Pavel, expressed my interest in his work, and he said, by all means, come and see me.
Just have to turn the tape. Okay.
Okay, well, I don't know, you could probably talk more about the problems of moving to England in 1959, but Anyway, Walter Pavel was just a delightful gentleman.
And where were you at? University College?
Yes.
Okay.
And that's something also. I think nearly everyone who was applying for Fulbrights wanted to go to Oxford or Cambridge. I applied directly for University College because Douglas McKee was there. And he really was one of the very few people who was working on anything related to the history of chemistry. And I'm glad we went there also because it was nice to have been in London or have lived in London. I think I always liked London better than Cambridge. I never got to know Oxford very well, although I was there several times. But London is just a wonderful place. Great place to look for books, too. At least it was then.
Well, we'll have to talk about that then when we get to the books part.
Anyway, Walter Pavel invited me to see him, and I found out how to get way out to Mill Hill by the tube and by bus and walking. We had a car, by the way, and I felt that this would probably be the only time we ever get to Europe, and I should see something. Those times have changed too, but at that time I didn't expect to see much. I was amazed when back at Indiana, one of my professors, Professor Townsend of Ancient History, had actually been to Greece. And no one else. Well, anyway, Pavel was, as I say, just such a friendly person, and his wife was as well. And in the end, every time I went to England, I would see him once a week, spend an afternoon at his place once a week. He had a study just filled with books. Books you couldn't possibly find anymore. Most of them were auctioned at Sotheby's after his death. But it was a remarkable collection. Well, anyway, I learned an awful lot from that man. He was very generous, and it was a wonderful experience knowing him. So I would say that there's the person who really was the director of my dissertation at a distance.
You didn't really get your degree, if I look at these dates correctly, until you came back from England. Is that correct?
That's right. We spent the year 59 and 60 in London, and I completed my research on the dissertation and wrote most of it. We were back in Cambridge, Massachusetts the following year, and I finished writing it and graduated, and I got the degree in June of 61. And in the meantime, I had the job at Chicago. That's a case where Cohen was a great help to me. At the time, there were very few positions in the history of science, and in fact, the profession was a pretty small one. The History of Science Society met in New York in December of 1961, and I gave a paper. People were allowed to give longer papers then, too. I gave a 45-minute paper based on my dissertation. And Cohen knew about the job at Chicago, and Cyril Stanley Smith was at Chicago, and he was at that meeting. Of course, Smith, the great historian of science as well as being a great scientist, and I can still remember when I went in to give my paper, there was Cohen. He took Cyril Stanley Smith by the arm, walked him down to the front of the hall, so he would be sure to hear. And Smith, he was a great fellow too. I liked him. I wish he was leaving Chicago just as I arrived. But years later, he gave me some of his books, including a very rare one that I have here, and I'll always be indebted to that man too. And I only wish I had known him, seen him more often. Well, he went to MIT.
Mm-hmm. At the time that you were still a graduate student, how many other students could you identify in the history of chemistry? Or were you it?
I was the only one. Another one became very prominent in the history of chemistry, but years later, and that's Larry Holmes.
Oh, yes.
He did a great deal of work on Lavoisier, for instance, among other things. And he came after. Actually, there was a Japanese graduate student, Nakayama. I don't know where he is now. I think he came to the United States eventually. But he gave a talk at Chicago once, and I ran into him on the street. And he was very interested in pointing out that he was, I think, the seventh PhD out of Harvard in the history of science, and I was the eighth or something like that. There were very few of us.
And the others were not in, would be physics or biology or something besides chemistry.
Yes. In fact, when we entered in 1956, I was one of three new graduate students for Cohen. The other two were Bill Coleman, who's now dead about 20 years, died at about 50, 53. He worked in 19th century biology. And the third one was George Basala, who taught at the University of Delaware, was still in close contact.
When did that all change? When did the history of chemistry start to attract more people? I may be jumping ahead, but...
Yeah, I think you are. there was this long interest in Lavoisier. The French were interested in Lavoisier. And McKee taught it at University College. Partington, of course, wrote his great books, really, and had been interested. Well, that's a great man. That's another person who was impressive. I had a friend at University College who was a teaching for the first year. You don't mind if I...
Oh, this is fine. This is fine.
And Bill Smeaton.
Yes.
He was... just my age and was just starting. Well, I had taught at a technical college, and McKee hired him to do the history of chemistry at University College. And he started the same year that I got there as a student working on my dissertation. And Smeaton was working on the in the McKee tradition, really, on the 18th century, early 19th century, especially the very late 18th century French chemistry. So there was that. And Smeaton, well, we got along well together. We went to see shows together. And
nice person.
Yeah, awfully nice guy. And a couple of times, he took me to visit Partington at his home in Cambridge.
Mm.
And he was a very interesting man. He was pretty old at the time. I don't know how old, but he was straight as a ramrod. He'd been in the army in ordnance, I think it was. I don't remember. And he was, I guess, close to as far as he could go with his four-volume magnum opus. And at the time, he was working on volume one, which was the last, which he never finished. And we just sat in this little room on the second floor. There's books around him on shelves. And there next to the window, stack of papers so high, just with notes for volume one. I was told once that the book he published in the mid-30s on some technical chemistry and something, I don't have that, had something like 25,000 references. I don't know. I never tried to check it out, but someone told me this.
Well, he did write a multi-volume series on physical chemistry.
Oh, physical chemistry.
Physical chemistry.
Yeah, not the history of it.
No, just physical chemistry. Yeah. It was three volumes or something like that.
And at Northwestern, was it Northwestern? I think it was Northwestern. I took his took a course in advanced inorganic chemistry, and used a one volume work that I still have upstairs. That was the best book I had in inorganic chemistry.
Somewhere I recall that he said that whatever reference he put in the book, he read.
I don't doubt it.
And when you look at some of those references, it's really very impressive if he read them, because they were not always in English, they were other languages.
Well, he was interested in the smallest things. He knew that I had been interested in Robert Fludd. He hadn't spent much time on Robert Fludd. He wasn't interested in that kind of a more mystical chemist, really. I have a little note from him that he sent me after I saw him at his place, and he's talking about the correct spelling of Flood's name, and in his book he has F-L-U-D, and most of the reference I know of have a double D, and he wanted to bring this up.
So you arrived in Chicago in 61.
Yes.
Do you have any other possibilities, or was Chicago it?
There was one other one, and that was Ohio State. That's Columbus, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had that offer. I don't, and I remember I went down to interview with the University of Delaware, but I don't think anything came of that. I had the Ohio offer, which I held off a while because I knew that they were thinking about it at Chicago. It so happened that my father had to go to the hospital, and I went home to see him. My father said, well, if you're interested in the job, go down and talk to them. Tell them that you're here, which I did. And they didn't bother to have me give a paper or anything for them. I had lunch with a bunch of people, and then in what seemed like far too much time, they made me an offer.
And this is the history department?
Yes.
What was the history of science like in the history department? Was it a sub-discipline within the department?
There wasn't any. I was the first one.
You were it.
There were two other people who were interested in it. Well, there was someone else, yes. Ilse Veith. I don't know. She's a historian of medicine from Austria. And she really didn't have much interest in the history department, so they didn't have much interest in her as a result.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, was her fault. And it's not that she was a bad scholar or anything, but she was interested in medicine, and she got managed to get an office in the medical school, and she had luncheons with medical students, and they loved her over there. But the history department didn't do much, and they just didn't want to do anything. She got an offer in the medical school in San Francisco, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And she went there, and so I was there in history. And in the meantime, Bob Palter, who must be retired now, he went someplace in Connecticut. Bob Palter was in the philosophy department at Chicago. And he was giving an undergraduate course in the history and philosophy of science. And so there was that course, and there was that undergraduate course. My appointment was two-thirds in the undergraduate teaching in college and one-third in the history department. Now, in those days, the history department, if you said you were in the history department, it was largely graduate teaching. In the undergraduate program, there weren't enough students for me to be in Bob Palter's program, course, really. And as a result, two-thirds of my time was teaching physics. Not chemistry, physics.
Mm.
Which I am not. However, we do things like this. So when I taught the history of science, it was largely to graduate students in the history department. And what, one course a year or something. After a year or two, how did I do that? Oh, no, I didn't do it, really. Bill McNeil did. Bill McNeil liked my work, and he was the chairman of the history department at the time. And he increased my participation in history. I think he made me first either half or two-thirds history, the rest the undergraduate college program. And And then I became full-time history. So the program at Chicago became, at least when I was starting, it was largely a graduate program for history students.
Were you able to attract students to the history of chemistry?
Well, over the over the years, I have had several excellent students. Some of them in the history of science. Not at the beginning necessarily, although I had some who wrote some interesting papers early. But one of the books that started in my seminar was a book by Nicholas Cluley on John Dee that is, I think, now considered the standard work on John Dee. Michael Walton is another one of my students, and he keeps writing papers all of the time on Paracelsian-related topics. Who else would I name? I have some who aren't. I have some I'm very close to who didn't even end up in the history of chemistry. One of them is Karen Parshall at the University of Virginia. And Karen has written a terrific book, really a superb book on John Joseph Sylvester, 19th century mathematician. You mean we're ready for another one already?
Almost.
Who else, Bruni?
Oh, a Chinese student.
Oh, yeah. Kevin Chang, who was my last student to get a degree. He's a member of the Academia Sinica in Taiwan, and he's constantly traveling the world. He came to us he wasn't really admitted to the graduate program at first because I think because they're always a little bit wary about people coming from other countries with different basic languages. But he picked up English rapidly. He became interested in 17th and 18th century chemistry. And this past year, this current year, he spent 6 months, no, 4 months at the Institute at Princeton, and now he's at Yale University, and he's published some wonderful papers, and as well along with a book dealing with the educational system in 18th century Germany. It just, he amazes me. He's picked up German, he's picked up French, he's picked up Latin. He didn't have any of these. It's just a remarkable
person. Not even English when he came.
It's a remarkable person. And again, a very nice one.
During your tenure at Chicago, how did the department change? Were there more people added in the history of science?
Yeah. And the sometimes not exactly the way that you would want. If you're building a program, it would be nice to say, well, we need somebody here, we need somebody there, and let's push for these fields and these people. But I think it's important to have the fields covered that you wanted above all, and then find someone in the field. Sometimes I think they go about it the wrong way and say, we'll take anybody doing anything provided it's a very prominent person. And I don't think that's the way to build a program, but that's just a personal view. Anyway, back in the 60s, the Oriental Institute at the university had some people. One of them was David Pingree, who eventually went to Brown University and became the successor to Otto Neugebauer. Pingree was, he died a year ago, is another one of these remarkable people who have just an amazing talent for languages, from Sanskrit to heaven knows what. David knew of a brilliant young man at Yale University, and that was Noel Sverdlow. And he wanted Noel Sverdlow. The money came from the Oriental Institute or something like that. And so if someone says, look, you can have another person, here's the salary, that's one way to go. But again, you're not really doing it necessarily the way you want to build it. Noel is still teaching at Chicago. He's very technically minded, and he has had, I believe, a number of fine students, but he hasn't. I've been on some of the oral examinations that he has chaired. But he hasn't had many students that you call history of science as a whole. They've been history of some ancient mathematics or astronomy, sometimes up farther. He's done some important work on, translated one of the works of Copernicus, the Commentariolus. So we had that, and then occasionally we get people from other departments who have an interest in the history of science as well. But we never at any time had a large number of people teaching it. We have used, now I'm retired for 10 years, mind you, but I'm talking about when I was doing it. We tried to use help throughout the university. One of our first PhD students was Will Provine, who went to Cornell University. And Will was interested in 20th century molecular biology, which is not my field. I had to represent him in the history department because he was getting a history degree. Did you want to change it?
Okay.
But we had to have someone from one of the biologists to work with him. And that means, of course, that in a case like that, you have to have the biologist satisfied that the historian knows enough science to deal with the topic he wants to work on. And so Will ended up doing almost a master's degree in molecular biology with Richard Lewontin, who went to Harvard. And we had cases like that, always utilizing scientists when we could for one of the students, or sometimes working within the history department, of course, if a person was working on some aspect of 17th century or something, you get someone who's doing 17th century intellectual history, if you can. But you have to somehow spread it rather than holding it just within the one or two people who call themselves historians of science or chemistry or whatever.
You never had a separate department?
No, I didn't want a separate department.
Like Penn had a separate department.
Yeah. The reason I didn't want it is because I really wasn't interested in being an administrator. I felt that I had to be to a certain extent, but I really wasn't very interested in getting involved in financial matters and determining people's salaries and things like that. Now, we did have a change in the 70s when the friends of Morris Fishbein decided to honor him on his 80th birthday by setting up a center in his name. Morris Fishbein wanted it to be a program. I think he would have been happy just with a professorship in the history of medicine. But
could you tell me something about Morris Fishbein? My ignorance.
Okay. Fishbein was a person who got his medical degree at Rush Medical College in Chicago and became famous primarily as a medical journalist.
JAMA.
He was the editor of JAMA for many years, 25 years at least. And he wrote columns constantly. He was very much interested in attacking medical quacks, wrote books on it. He wrote an awful lot of books, and he said that he could read a book every night. He did read a book every night, he said. I don't know how he did it. He was a remarkable man. Now, there was an administrator. I was on a board once at the Chicago Surgical College. What was it? History of Surgery. Mm-hmm. Chicago History of Surgery Museum. And he was the head of the committee. It was a committee to determine who the lecturer is going to be for the former year. And I got there, and a number of the people were there, and started talking about this and that and the other thing. And finally, Morris Fishbein came in and sat down and said, "Okay, this is what we're going to do."
He and his wife were very nice, you know. When Alan became the director, we had parties here and everything. He will come with his chauffeur and park right in front and bring the liquor here. And they had a great time, you know. It was a very, very nice person, both of them. We had a great time with them.
We established this Morris Fishbein Center for the History of Science in medicine. It's a center, not a department. And we set up a lecture series. And we always had the Fishbines come, of course, to the lecture. We invited, anyway. And Mrs. Fishbein would always look at the audience. She'd count them. And then she let us know later how it compared with the audience as her husband.
Now, did the endowed chair that you held start at the same time? Or was that earlier?
It's not an endowed chair.
Okay. I assume that only because it's a named chair. Okay.
Yeah, it started at that time. I mean, our first plan was to look for someone who was strictly history of medicine, because that's what the Fishbines had in mind. We invited one person to come and give a course for a quarter, I guess it was, from Germany. His name was Kutlin. Anyway, that really didn't work out. His wife didn't like it, and I don't think anyone particularly cared for him. He didn't set off any wildfires or anything, but anyway, they named me the Fishbein Professor. So that's how that happened.
Does the Institute still exist? Is that still?
Yes.
Okay.
The present director is Bob Richards, who was one of my students, actually.
As I looked over your Chicago career, the output of your work is really quite impressive. It's astounding to me.
I'm
just looking at
it's enough. To be honest with you.
Well, I think I understand that, but for me to look at just the books that you've published alone it's quite a remarkable record. And your last one just last year.
Yeah. Well, that's mainly a collection of papers.
Okay. You pretty much, from what I can tell, and I'm a chemist, I'm not a historian of science. My background is chemistry, although I've been doing, from a chemist standpoint, history of chemistry for some years now. But you sort of never left the 17th century. Am I correct, or am I misreading it?
No, that's right. 16th, 17th, and into the 18th.
What was the fascination to you of that period that kept you in that period for your career?
I think my... some water, maybe? Would you like some water?
Yes, please. Thank you.
I think it's because... at first, I was interested in alchemy, and I remember I picked up a book on Broadway in Chicago. There was a little bookstore there, and it was a reprint of a translation from the 15th century. And at the end of it, it had a short description of how to make gold, and it made up sense about halfway through, and then it became ridiculous, and it was just an interest in what did this mean? And I think that there are several ways that you can look at this. I think that today there's a great deal of interest in going through manuscripts that that can be interpreted chemically, and that's fine. I became interested in something else, though, and that is that when you're dealing with the 16th century, and if you've been trained in the history of science, and if you were trained at the time that I was trained, the emphasis was on the great change that occurs with Copernicus and with Vesalius and the people who followed them, in one case leading to Galileo and Kepler and Newton, the other case leading to Harvey, and in other words, it is a scientific revolution that occurs, and chemistry plays no real part in it. But it seemed to me, and I remain convinced it's true, that just as important at the time was Paracelsus, who said that if you're going to look at the world, you've got to do it differently. To be sure, he has a lot of hermeticism and other mystical aspects of it, but he also brings in chemistry. He says you have to go out into nature, you have to study nature, and after you go and collect examples of nature, you take it back into your laboratory, and in effect you analyze it with the fire. This is this is something that was very attractive to many people who were sometimes not so much interested in trying to just deal with changing base metals into gold. They were interested in something more than that, trying to understand nature and understanding nature through chemistry or examining nature in that fashion. That's what has always interested me more than going through chemical, well, attempts to make gold.
Is alchemy making a comeback? There was a time when that was one of the major topics, then it seemed to disappear for a while, or at least decline.
You mean in the history of science?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Bill Newman and Larry Principe won the Pfizer Award last year for their book, Alchemy Trodden the Fire. And that's very gratifying to me. To know that there are, well, I don't know, you do know of the meeting they held last
mm-hmm.
July.
Mm-hmm.
Lots and lots of people from all over Europe and the United States. I was surprised. That was very nice for us to be invited to attend.
Our manuscript resources from that period, are there still many that haven't been looked at, or?
Oh, I think so, yes.
Okay. And are they becoming more available?
Well, it's going to take a lot of people to do this, but you know, there's something else. It's not only the manuscript sources that are important. You have to keep in mind that the printed books of the period haven't really been studied.
Hmm.
And those are the documents that people could get at. I think there's more and more of an attempt to get to manuscript sources, and that's great if you're trying to understand Isaac Newton. You've got a lot of Newton manuscripts all over. Again, I was at King's College. My friend Pio Ratansi, who was another good friend of Walter Pagel, he had a year at King's College to look through the Newton manuscripts there. And he invited me up there once to look at them. Big stack Newton manuscripts. And they're going to publish, I think, and translate all of these, just as they have the works he wrote on physics of motion and everything else. But it's going to take a long time before people read all of this material. Perhaps it's because of my connection with Walter Pagel, who was really most interested in books. I can see the importance of looking at the books that people could read rather than the manuscript notes of the individual, which might be kept in his own laboratory. Or I don't think, for instance, that much of Newton's work on alchemy was available. I mean, this was something only on paper that he kept to himself. Well, I'd have to talk to Bill Newman, I guess. He might argue with me, but I don't think so. It's a way to understand Newton, and that's important. But I'd rather see what the place of chemistry is in the scientific revolution as a whole, with the material that was available to all people. For instance, there was a great debate in Europe in the late 16th and throughout the 17th century over chemistry. And this is something that affected the physicians, to be sure, because the chemists were saying it's the only way you can understand the human body or anything else. Everything is chemical. The human body separates the pure from the impure, discards the impure, and builds the pure material of food into body parts. They tried to use chemistry to explain everything they saw in the world, this is something that was of no interest to people who were rolling balls on inclined planes. They were just different approaches, and chemistry deserves to be considered a major factor. I have a group of books on the shelf there by Joseph Duchesne. I managed to find them. They're all from the period from 1575 to about 1610. And he was involved in a big debate with people in France over the chemical interpretation of nature. Well, that's getting out of the book.
No, that's fascinating. What about this country? Was there any... What were the earliest... I don't know what the word is I want to use. Uh, 17th century in this country. Was there anything going on?
Well, there was this one person that Bill Newman has dealt with, George Starkey.
Okay.
Harvard, 1646.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, there's not much other than Winthrop, Governor Winthrop.
Okay.
Wrote to the Royal Society. He was interested in it. And I read that a few years ago they were excavating Jamestown, I think, and they found some distilling flasks.
That's actually going to be an ACS National Historic Chemical Landmark at Jamestown.
Oh, great.
This year, next year, whatever the anniversary is, they're going to... It was a little complicated because they had to get National Park Service approval, and they can only use their signage and not the American Chemical Society plaque. But anyways, it is going to happen. So
that's good. I'm glad to hear that. But you can't really say that there's any teaching of chemistry, and Starkey's work seems to have been done in London rather than in Cambridge.
Well, Priestley's move to the United States almost seems, in many respects, to be the beginning of...
Yeah, you have to get down to that period, really. I imagine there's some others. I remember it at one book sale I saw, one American imprint from the 1790s on chemistry. But I can't think of anything offhand.
Well, maybe we should start talking about books. You've alluded to some at this point, but have you always been a book collector, even when you were young?
Well, I was a collector. I've been a collector of many things, actually.
I heard you have quite a record collection.
Yeah, I've got about, I think, at least 15,000 records, cylinders and discs.
That's amazing.
When I was a kid, I collected stamps and coins. Now I even have a 1932 Piercero.
Really? Yeah. Oh, my. Is that why there's a print up there of the... I don't know if that's the Piercero or not.
Yeah, that's the Piercero.
Okay.
Both of them.
How long have you had it?
For 10 years. I'll show you the picture. I know that won't show up on the tape, but I'll show you the picture anyway. It's a nice car.
Oh, my. Oh, yes, that is wonderful. Was there any particular reason for this car?
Well, no, there aren't too many Pierceros that turn up for sale. But there was a retired United Airlines pilot in Marengo, which is about 40 miles west of here. And his uncle had willed him the car. And he really wasn't very interested in it. And he put an ad in the Chicago Sun-Times, which I happened to see, and went to look at it, and we decided to get it.
Was it restored, or did you have to do work to it?
I didn't do anything to it. It had been partially restored, but it was in very good shape. But I've been a record collector since the late 30s. And now one of the things I do is prepare. I program and write notes for CDs on historical recordings.
Any particular type of music?
Yeah, American popular music.
Okay.
I like vaudeville. And I think, furthermore, it's important. I've given several talks on topics like this. I've been interested in the fact that so much ethnic comedy material was popular at the time. I mean, to be sure, there was African-American dialect, but a lot of other dialects, people coming into the country at the time, and seemed to be part of our culture, and certainly acceptable then.
I can remember when I was a kid, I had an uncle who had there were still old 78s. In fact, my grandfather had a Victrola that similar to what's over in the corner there.
That's my great aunt's. That's the one I first listened to old records on.
Well, I found my grandfather's in his attic, and I think I got him to at least show me how it worked. But my uncle had a big collection of big band music that on the 78s, but I used to sit and listen to them for hours, and I was just fascinated by that. And I tell my children about the big band era, they have no idea what I'm talking about for the most part.
Well, my records are, most of them before 1930, and a lot of them going back even to the 1890s.
Mm.
And nobody can understand that material. Only I can.
Have you written about this? Have you written?
Yeah.
What? So that developed very early in your life.
Yes, very early.
Yeah. It's fascinating. So you collected records, you collected stamps, you collected coins. When did you think that you wanted to collect books?
Well, I suppose in the early 40s, occasionally I would look in at a bookstore when I was downtown. There were a fair number of used bookstores in Chicago then, not today, but and I remember picking up a little early 19th century part of a series of history books of different countries, and that interested me. But it wasn't until later that I became interested in the history of science and the history of chemistry. When I was a graduate student at Indiana, I ran into a book catalog from somebody in Cincinnati. And they listed the works of Van Helmont, and it was 1682 edition for $10. And so I sent for it. I got it up on the shelf there.
Sidney Edelstein tells the story of his visiting Eva Armstrong in the Smith Collection somewhere in the 40s and telling her that he had a chance to buy a Robert Boyle for $25. And she said, well, Dr. Smith never paid more than $5 for a Boyle. It's way overpriced.
Now everything's overpriced. But I got that book for $10. It turned out to be missing an illustration, but that I had the text. And I picked this book up just at a time when I was becoming really interested in the field. And it seemed to me that what I needed the texts. Above all, I needed the texts. I think this would be different from a lot of collectors who wanted beautiful bindings and large paper copies and all of this. I wanted the text. Now, I continue to see an occasional catalog, and when we were living in Waukegan, when I was working at Abbott's, I remember getting some catalogs from a London dealer, G.W. Walford. He had his store on 186 Upper Street.
Thank you.
I still remember that. And he had a 1664 edition of Francis Bacon's Silva Silvarum that I sent for. I think it was only about £4. And I became convinced about that time that it would be possible to get an occasional book. Now, we weren't making very much money in those days. I think when I went to Abbott's, my salary was $3,900. Bruni was getting $3,700 because she was a woman. She had exactly the same credentials, but we just didn't have enough money to spend on other things, really. And things weren't any better when we went back to graduate school. I didn't. Well, of course, I bought books when I was at Harvard, but I didn't really think of antiquarian books. I like getting books, and I bought new books in my field. I guess it really wasn't until I went to England in 1959. Pavel was a real book collector. He used to have new catalogs on his desk all the time. He told me, look at every catalog that comes your way. Makes no difference what it's on. A dealer might have something that doesn't fit into the category and just see if someone will take it. So I've always looked at all of the catalogs that I see. I don't get as many today. I don't buy as much. But I used to... He also used to bid on Sotheby auctions pretty regularly. And I used to work at the British Museum. British Library was, of course, in the center there at the museum in those days. And at lunchtime, I would go out and walk down Charing Cross Road. It wasn't all that far away. And the other bookstores around there, used to find things there. And I used to start getting catalogs, and I used to start buying when I thought something would give me another text that I wanted. And
so you were still thinking in terms of material you were going to use.
Oh, yeah.
Rather than buying it for just having it.
Yeah.
As a collector's item.
That's right. I would pick up some things that I think I might possibly use in the future. And if there was something that particularly caught my fancy, I might get something. But if I point out books to you, I'll show you what I mean. I went after collections, if I could, in order to get collect the texts, because it's so much cheaper to get one book rather than 10 individual, maybe earlier, editions of the single text.
So. Were there any unexpected treasures that you found by accident?
Yeah, I guess some. One of them comes to mind particularly. In all places, it turned up in Chicago. In my first couple of years of teaching at Chicago, I used to read the university newspaper, the Maroon. And there was a book dealer who advertised. He was west of the Loop in an Italian neighborhood. And I went out there to see what he had. And here was this bookstore filled with old books in the middle of the Italian neighborhood of Chicago. And in time I found out that it was an Italian who had come to Chicago because his wife was American. And before he left Italy, he had bought out a noble's library in Bari. And again, it wasn't a time when I could buy a great deal, but I did buy some things. And he did have some early chemistry material. One of the things that I got, two Lavoisier items that were unknown to Duveen. This is the, well, can I show them to you?
Or? Sure, sure. No, please do.
Since then, somebody has found a second copy. I don't know, maybe it's Neville for all I know. But this was a translation of Lavoisier's treatise on chemistry, made for the, I think, the artillery school in Naples.
Oh my.
In two volumes. And I wrote to Nuveen about it because, well, I wrote a paper on it for Ambix. And that's no help.
Ambix 1963. I'll look it up when I get back. Forgotten chapter in the introduction of the new chemistry in Italy.
And this was just at a time when Duveen was putting out the second volume of his Lavoisier thing. And he pointed out, he didn't spell my name right. But anyway.
How well did you know Duveen?
I didn't know him well.
Oh, okay.
I corresponded with him in regard to this book and to another one. And then when I was lecturing in Sao Paulo, he was living in Brazil at the time, and I called him on the phone and spoke to him.
I have tried to trace down his lineage to the Duveen family, which is suspect.
Really?
Yes.
That's something.
Only out of personal curiosity, when I discovered that he ended up dying in Brazil, but was there are many orchids named after him, and that's what he was doing down there, was orchids.
Yeah, he was interested in perfumes, too. Although maybe...
Well, he had the soap company in New York at one time, and okay, first recorded in Ambics, and this is from his supplement to the bibliography.
Yeah, I was very pleased that I had found that. And there was a second one that I found, too. At the time I found this, which is complete, I found volume 4 only of another Italian translation, also in the same shop. And I think the rest of it's in the first three volumes are somewhere in Chicago, because for years after that, when we were looking at houses, I found in these model homes they would have books on shelves, and they had his little mark at the bottom.
I had a friend who said at one time he found some great books in furniture stores.
Yeah, probably.
Because they just put anything on the shelf to make it look like books on the shelf.
Yep.
And they didn't know what the books were. And what is the library here in the... It's...
Does it say Sisto? I don't remember.
I don't have my reading glasses.
Let me see. This is the little thing that you find. Yeah, Sisto's Antique Library.
Okay. Well, that's a marvelous...
This was unknown to Dooley, too. And this is the other volume, part of a four-volume set of another Italian translation of the same thing. He had a number of books that I picked up.
Did you feel pleased that you found things that were unknown to Duveen?
Yes.
Given his collection. Well, that's a great answer. I like that. Were these unknown to Neville, too?
I don't know about that. I never really knew Neville.
Fascinating. I assume that the 35 in pencil mark on the title page is the price?
I don't know, that's probably cost me more than that, but it wouldn't have cost more than a couple of dollars. You meant 35 cents?
No, $35.
Oh, no, I never would have paid $35 at that time.
Well, Neville was a chemist who collected on the side, too. He spent his whole career as a chemist. And
of course, that's not really my... That's late for me to deal with the late 18th century. I had another thing that was kind of interesting that I got out of the same library. I don't know if I can find it. It was an 18th century manuscript. But it was just a textbook for probably a monastic school.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a... I don't want to waste too much time.
Oh, no, that's all right. Don't worry. It's your time. I've got lots of time, and I've got lots of tape, so...
well, I don't know. Maybe I'll see it on the shelves. trouble is, this is arranged largely according, alphabetically, according to author.
Oh, okay.
And the book does not have an author. I have it under... Oh, there it is. This is
it. I work
hard. I don't know why I put it here.
Because this will be transcribed, if you could read the title and whatever else that we can then put into the transcript about the book, that would be helpful.
Well, this is an 18th century Italian manuscript. Well, sort of a beginning to philosophy. And now that's probably the price, probably $4. It's rather nice because it has diagrams, including diagrams of the systems of the world.
Oh my.
There's Tycho Brahe's system. And Copernicus.
Let's see if I can. Okay. Wow. Oh my.
And Ptolemy. And this dates from the 1730s, so it's really not very early. But it's rather a nice manuscript. I've never really thought very much about that one, but maybe I should have. This is a nice 17th century English alchemical text, a philosophical epitaph. I would assume that this is in the Neville collection. What do you want me to show you?
Well, what you want to show. What do you want to brag about? Or watch, there's a... You don't... Okay. I'll leave that up to you.
Well, I have a couple of fairly important early This is a 15-1 edition of Ficino on the Three Lives, Books of Three Lives. And this has a good deal of astrology and medicine in it, and was influential on Paracelsus.
Oh, okay. Now, when you bought these, were these bound like this?
This one was, yeah.
Okay. I wondered whether you ever had anything restored or...
Oh, yes, I have. I have. I'll show you a nice example of that. Had this binding done in England. I bought it in Chicago. There was I was looking through Isis once, and there was a review, a devastating review by George Sarton of a translation of Ptolemy's Tetrabiblos. And it was done, evidently, or at least published, by an astrologer. And I thought, well, I should be in touch with these occult stores. It was in Chicago. So I went there, near this little old man, had a bookcase full of old books, and in included was the works of Glauber. It was in a horrendous bright orange library binding. So I had it rebound. All of his books were cheap. Very cheap. I was very lucky.
Was there any particular person that you used to do this? Did you have...
I don't remember. Most of the books I had rebound in England were rebound in Cambridge, I think, by, if I remember correctly, it was Gray.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah,
let me get a picture. If you hold that, I'll get a picture.
What, the back or the inside?
Yeah, hold it so I can, since we're talking about, this. Okay.
What I was talking about before, though, is that my interest in getting collected editions. And in alchemy, what I went after and was able to get eventually was the key collected editions of alchemical works. Manger, for instance, the two-volume Manger of 1702.
May I open it for?
Yes, sure. I'm afraid it's not going to hold much longer anyway.
Well, I won't do it then. Now that when you say collected works, that's a collection of manuscripts that are put together, or?
Well, and in here they're printed, of course.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. But some of them go back to an early period and go up to the 17th century. Another major collected edition is the Museum Hermeticum. I had these boxes made for me. This is 1678, and this way. Thank you.
Oh my.
Go ahead. Well,
that's all right.
There are better ones than that, anyway. There we've got the universe. Now, this is something that I'm sure is in the Neville collection. It's a famous work.
When we bought this house, you know, he came, brought all his books, all of his records, and then come and tell me, I'm already moved.
Were the bookshelves here, or did you build those?
Yes, no, we had them built. This was a model house, so when we bought it, we had them built. They were the bookcases for him. But his books and his records, that's what his house was all about.
How do you store all those records?
They're on shelves that we bought something called jar shelves, and they're just right for 10-inch records. There are other plates. It takes a while to find them, though.
Have you cataloged your collection?
Yes. They're on 3x5 cards.
Okay. And how many would there do you have approximately?
I really have no idea. They're all around the house.
I don't have a collection like this, but my books are all over the house too.
And the records are for the most part in the basement, which is not the best place in the world for them. And what else could I... Oh, I had a special interest in Robert Boyle. And this is a case where I finally got the 1772 6-volume edition.
Oh my.
And this, but you see again, I take it in a bad binding to get the text.
Sure. Robert Schofield, who's a priestly.
Right, I know him well.
Told us in Philadelphia after he had finished the last Priestley volume, and he wasn't going to touch Priestley ever again, and he sold all his Priestley books.
Oh, I had no idea.
And he said he collected those books simply to use for his work. He did not collect them for any other reason. And when he was finished with Priestley, he didn't want the books anymore. So I guess he made notes, he did whatever. He wasn't worried about condition, he wasn't worried about anything else. They were simply a resource for him.
Well, these are a resource for him, but I like having them, too.
Yes. But I'm pretty sure that he sold most of the Priestley books after he finished that second volume recently. How can I phrase this? What was the most you spent on a book, if I may ask?
I'm not even certain. I probably haven't spent the most expensive one I can think of at the moment. At the moment is Libavius, his alchemy, which I paid $350 for.
Is this another one you had rebound?
No. That's the way I bought it.
Okay. Oh, my. Notice that you have also signed your name in these books.
Sometimes.
Okay, I wanted to ask if that was a standard practice or...
No, not always.
My grandmother's brother bought a 3-volume Bible in Philadelphia and signed his name in the front like this. And many years later, it was discovered the Bible belonged to Bach.
My goodness.
And his notes are in the margins, and his name is on the title page. The J and the S and the B are intertwined on the title page. And there have been 2 PhD theses done on this Bible, and but he didn't know it. And it was discovered by accident by somebody else. Mm. And they gave the Bible to the Lutheran Seminary in St. Louis, which is where it is now.
Interesting. That's really interesting. This is another famous work, the Theatrum Chemicum Britannicum.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. That's a nice binding, too.
That's from Walter Pachel. He didn't like things that...
Oh, his name's in it, yes. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
He didn't like books that weren't perfect.
Okay.
And this has, something is replaced in it. Anyway, anything that he thought I might like that he wasn't satisfied with, he'd let me have for £10.
That Edgar Faz Smith, when he'd bring things to American Chemical Society meetings, and they would get together and just show each other the parts of their collection, he would give people things to get them started in collecting.
Oh, I know somebody else who did that too. Aurel LaRocque, a historian of geology, would give books away to people who would work on them. That some things I don't want to bother you with too much, but some things that are quite rare. One of them, I can find it here. I had this one rebound. This is the first book by an Englishman, it's in Latin, on the Paracelsian system. It's a very rare book.
Moffat.
He was a member of the Royal College of Physicians.
Did you get this in England or here?
To be honest with you, I don't remember.
What kind of information do you have on your 3x5 cards?
I don't have the price. I don't necessarily, and I probably don't have the where I got it, the dealer. And I bought from dealers. I never bid on in auctions like Pavel did. I didn't think I'd have a chance. But I have the just the normal thing that you would find in a library card. Author, title.
Well, marvelous.
When he graduated, Life magazine came and took pictures of us.
Really?
Because we had two kids and the family were there, and so they took a picture of him with myself and the two little children, and I said, and there's a baby in the house that I left behind. So they published it.
Really?
Yes.
What year?
Yeah, what year? 1961.
Well, it wasn't published in Life, though.
Yeah, we have the picture.
Yes, we have the picture. They took the pictures, they didn't publish the pictures. We sent the pictures to Harvard, uh-huh. And they published it in their graduate.
In the graduate school.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, well, it was real funny.
Maybe we can. I'll send somebody looking for that. See if we can find.
Well, I think we have the picture somewhere, Alan, don't we?
We have
the picture. We have the picture. If you want it, we can send you a copy.
Oh yes, yes, definitely. That would be nice.
So funny.
We would like to. A copy would be wonderful.
In fact, Larry Holmes' wife have had a baby at the same time, and he was not graduating, so she came to babysit with the baby. So
we had to go
to graduation.
This is the flood you were mentioning earlier.
This is the Robert Flood I was mentioning. This, I didn't know that this book was available. It's the first publication, second edition of the first publication by Robert Flood. And Sidney Edelstein told me about it.
Oh, really?
So I sent for it.
Okay. Did you have much interaction with Edelstein?
Not a great deal, but I knew him. And I met him at meetings, but also in Israel. We saw him there. And we took us to his apartment, or his daughter's apartment or something, right on the beach, Mediterranean. Very nice.
Did you go to any ACS meetings?
I've been to some, yes. And the last one I was at, I was at the ACS meeting in Chicago. The last one in Chicago, about 4 or 5 years ago, something like that. And I gave a paper there. It's when Bill Smeaton was given.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And I spoke at that time.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't go to that meeting. At one time, the History of Chemistry Division of the ACS had people who were really professional historians who were active in the division. And I'm including in that Aaron Ide, who was really a chemist, but by that time had really become a historian of chemistry and published his book, I think, in 61.
Yeah.
But there were others, too, who were... When the division started, it was mainly chemists. Edgar Foss Smith started the division for people to get the chemists to get together and show things from their collection. And Robert Brown, Charles A. Brown, at one of the meetings had the most unusual artifact of anybody, and that was a lock of John Dalton's hair.
My goodness.
And supposedly it's in the Smith Collection in Philadelphia. It shows up in a catalog as being there, but nobody can find it.
Hmm.
And I don't know how you prove that it's a lock of John Dalton's hair either, but that's what Brown claimed.
Well, he must have had some reason for it.
And this is with the two D's, and not the one.
It's always with the two D's, except for volume one of the History of the Macrocosm, which has it with one D. And that's what he was working from primarily.
Okay.
So, I don't... I've got a lot of important... Well, some of the early... textbooks, the chemical textbooks are interesting. And again, they must be in the Neville collection. This is one of the first books I got. Bruni and I were down on Wabash Avenue in Chicago and went into Croc in Brentano's bookstore, and on the second floor they had a whole bunch of old books, mainly in the history of chemistry, and this one I think was $17. I think you bought it for me. I have the works of Paracelsus in German and Latin. The Latin edition I have is from the library of the Prince of Liechtenstein for some reason.
How multilingual are you?
Not an awful lot by many people. I read English. I've written a book on the French Paracelsians. Their works are mainly in French. I use German. I use Latin. I use Spanish. I find Italian a maddening language.
Any reason?
All those little words that they have.
Okay. Did you develop this ability to read in all these languages on your own?
In high school, I had Latin and 1 year of Spanish. In college, I had, I think I only had Spanish in college. When I decided to go back to graduate school, I used to go in every week with Bruni, and we would study Latin and German and French with a retired professor of classical Greek. Hmm. That was kind of difficult as I look back. After working full day at Abbott Laboratories and driving into Evanston from Waukegan, I couldn't do it anymore.
And with roads that aren't like the roads today either, I assume.
Yeah, it's about, I guess it's 35 miles or so each way. And sometimes we would stop in Glenview on the way down to leave the kids with my parents. Oh, well, I'm older now. I've got more sense. I'd never go back to school again. I just jotted down some of the names when I was thinking you wanted to see some books. In addition to Paracelsus, I've got the English Van Helmont, which is a very desirable book. Again, I suppose that it's in the Neville collection. But I was very glad to get it. I don't think I've seen it on sale. And I don't know if I've ever seen it on sale. I got it from Lester King, who taught the history of medicine in our group. He was a senior editor of JAMA, and he published widely in the history of medicine. And he was through working on Van Helmont, and I had a beautiful copy of some other work that he wanted, so we just traded. But it's a nice, again, it's all the work of Van Helmont. And, very nice thing. This is an original binding. Moffat and Severinus is another major figure. I've got a couple of his works. Angela Sala. No one has really done any work on Angela Sala, who's another very important electrochemist. Oswald Kroll, he's important. I've got him in French and English. Beguin, I've got his textbook. Porter's work on distillation. Lefebvre, Glaser's important text of chemistry. Andernach, I've never seen that work on sale. I've got his work on the old and the new medicine from Walter Pagel for $10. It's this thick, it's down on the shelf there. And he was a teacher of Vesalius, and late in his life, when he must have been about 70, he started reading the work of Paracelsus and wrote this book, which included traditional medicine and then a discussion of all the new medicines that were coming in. And that's important because it made a real difference in pharmacy with the addition of all these chemically prepared medicines. Not that they were doing anyone any good. They were killing people. But they... I shouldn't be so harsh on the poor people. Sennert is another major name. I've got Sennert. And Digby. Becker. Stahl.
Oh my, yes. Oh.
I have Thomas Willis, whose early work is very much in the chemical tradition. And Sylvius, another iatrochemist. Boerhaave, I've got Boerhaave and Stahl and Lavoisier. These are... what I wanted was a collection that would be sort of a base collection. So I like working at home. And that's really what I worked up. It isn't enough to write a book from these. But it's enough to get the basis for a book in many cases. Another, I mentioned Starkey. Starkey is someone that seems to be a lot of interest today because he was of great interest to Isaac Newton. And this is another one of the works I picked up in that little astrology bookstore in Chicago.
Secrets Revealed. Now I noticed that you, in each of these books that you've shown me, you have information about that book from various sources that you've got.
When I see it.
Are they from catalogs?
Yeah,
or?
From catalogs.
Okay.
It's useful because it shows what people think in general about someone at the time. And at first I thought it would be helpful in regard to prices. The prices change so quickly that the prices really don't count for much.
Well, I guess in recent years that's really become, prices have really gone through the roof too, haven't they?
It's too bad. Really, it's too bad, because I think it's fun to collect. I never thought that the books would be worth a great deal. I'm not sorry that they've appreciated, but I mean, that Libavius, I paid $350 for. I think it's worth something like $15,000 today. Now, that's ridiculous, at least from my point of view. And that's a beautiful copy. I have other copies that would be worth less because they have a page in facsimile or something.
I think Roy Neville told me that at one point he thought about selling his collection and decided not to. But the price of the collection at the time he thought about it, of course he added after that, but it wasn't anywhere near what it brought later on. And he even admitted he never thought it would ever accrue to the value it did.
I wouldn't even know how to sell the books. I have so little interest in selling. I'm sure that dealers only give a fraction. And
are your children interested in them?
No.
Did any of them follow in your footsteps or become academics?
No, although the oldest boy is he's a chemist with the EPA in Chicago with a great interest in prehistoric life, and he's written 3 or 4 books already. But he really should have gone to graduate school, because the writing books and articles, that's what people in the academic world do, and that's how they get credit for what they've done. But in the EPA, it doesn't make much difference, except for himself. And that's important too.
Well, I think many academics do it for that reason too, that there's a certain amount of satisfaction you derive from the writing that you do, the research that you do, regardless of what anybody else.
Oh, well, yes, that's true. You don't go into the academic world for the money. At least I didn't. And I think it's true in most cases.
Yeah. I have some other questions, sort of general questions about your collection, but it may be time to turn this tape over first.
Okay.
Before I do that, then I won't have to. As you said earlier, didn't have the money. That was Neville went through that period too, where he said in the early days he knew he wanted to collect, but his funds were so limited that. But then he was working in the aerospace industry, so he as a practicing chemist. Well, we've already talked about, I would assume, the range of the subject matter, which is primarily material that was supporting the work you were doing. Is that a correct statement?
Yes.
Although, if you came across something else that was there anything you might have come across that didn't support your work, but caught your eye anyway?
Let me show you one.
Okay.
I can show you several, but show you one is probably worth as much as anything I have to.
First English translation of Euclid,
with the
introduction by John Dee. I'm interested in Dee, but this is not one of the topics of Dee that interests me especially. Although I had it reprinted. This was available, I picked it up by mail from catalog in Philadelphia. Willie Mallon, I don't know if he's still in business or not, but he had it for $200, if I remember correctly, missing 12 leaves. And I went to London, and at Dawson's, I don't think Dawson's is in business anymore, but they had a nice fellow there by the name of Osborne, and they had an imperfect copy of this work, and he sold me the missing 12 leaves for £12.
I've never heard of that. That's interesting, that they would essentially cannibalize the book.
It was a poor copy. The pages were in fine condition, but it was missing a lot.
Okay. Oh, yeah, there's a letter here from William Allen. Oh, Walnuts, 20th and Walnut Street. Okay.
Does that have the price on it?
No.
Well, I think it was $200. Not positive.
Neville mentioned this too. He says, if you would care to see the book on approval, I would be glad to send it on. Was that common practice, that they'd send you a book to look at before?
It was done on occasion with customers they knew. I don't think I asked anyone to do that. I think that I just said, send it, I'll buy it.
Okay. Well, I confessed that I was ignorant of John Dee until recently, and became quite fascinated with him.
And very interesting individual.
There is some group, at least I found them on the web, who is trying to reproduce Dee's library electronically.
Well, there are a bunch of English people interested in Dee, and they're always inviting my former student to speak to them. This is out of my area too, but I call it part of my collection. It's my great-grandfather's diary of his trip to the Klondike in 1898.
Oh, my. Yeah, St. Michael's, August 1898, Alaska, Norton Sound. Why was he in Alaska? Was he part of the gold rush?
Yeah. He left his wife and his lumber business in Chicago.
Did he strike anything?
No, he just came back with one nugget. So I have some books on extinct animals that I like.
My grandfather kept a daily diary from about 1880 to 1940, about 60 years worth.
And that's wonderful to have it that long period.
And there's hardly a missing page that day that he didn't write in.
Hmm.
And what intrigues me is that the handwriting never varies. It's always the same. Over all that period of time, you can't spot any difference in the handwriting. And I guess it's because he was a clerk in a county court, and he had to do it all by hand, so he took great pride in his handwriting. And I guess maybe he had carried over into his own. That's fascinating to have. Well, I asked you earlier about the number of volumes. Would you care to hazard a guess?
Well, it all depends what we're talking about. Are we talking about
altogether
pre 1900 imprints, or
well,
or I mean, I have lots of books that are current, recent. They're scattered all over the house.
Let's say pre 1900.
I think that there are about 800 in this bookcase, roughly. And these are relatively recent, most of them. So we slice out the sixth. Let's say 650 minus. There are some post 1900 books, but not many. They're called 650. There are some older books upstairs too.
What's the oldest?
The Ficino, I should have. Okay. 151.
We've talked about cataloging. We've talked about you had mostly, I would call them, working copies.
Yeah.
In the sense that most of it was for your own work.
Oh, yeah.
Anything that's inscribed or autographed?
You mean from the 17th century on?
Well, right. This was a question somebody else came up with on this general list of things, and that is, if you have a book with uncut pages, do you cut them?
generally no, unless I need to use the book. As I told you, I'll buy books that I think I might use sometime. And if I need to use the book, I'll try to limit myself to the pages I need. And that's really a question for a different kind of collector.
I actually bought a book one time that was almost all uncut pages. I bought it for another reason, but it was, the price was pretty low because of the pages weren't cut. I've cut a few of them, but not many. What are the, I think we've talked about this, the most prized books in your collection?
That's a hard.
It's like picking between your children.
Prized for different reasons, in a way. I'm very pleased with the books I have by Robert Flood. Getting very difficult to find these days. I think it's because of all of the plates in them. The book by Arnold of Villanova is a nice thing. I haven't shown that to you because it's on the top shelf.
That's fine.
The D is very nice. I have a beautiful copy of Kircher's Mundus Subterraneus. Ron Brashear was showing me the one in the Neville collection. Mine's a nicer one. I won't say that for much of anything else, but my copy of Kircher is better. I don't know. It's as a whole, rather than the individual items. I like the books by Joseph Duchesne that I managed to find, a nice group of them. But I not necessarily one or the other. I don't know. I mean, I have a lot of... again, you can't compare it to someone like Neville, who's
right.
Had a great deal of money to do this. But considering the fact that I was a student much of the time that I bought this, and an assistant professor. I'm really very pleased with what I managed to get.
No, it's a marvelous collection.
I don't know if it's a marvelous collection, it suited my purpose,
mm-hmm.
and it has been very useful to me. It's not just something that has been something to look at the bindings on the shelf.
Are you still buying?
I'm not buying books anymore because I really don't get very many catalogs, and when I do get catalogs, the prices are more than I really want to pay. Quite a bit more. A lot more than I want to pay. I am buying records still, and there it's a different order. Even though records there are getting to be quite expensive. An example is George M. Cohan made 6 records that were released in 1910.
Wow.
They're all rare, but one of them is especially rare. It's a song he wrote in 1897 and was classed as a coon song at the time. Called P.S. Mr. Johnson Sends Regards. I
picked up 3 copies of it over the years in beautiful shape, and it was listed in an auction catalog with a minimum bid of $250 last month. So even that sort of thing is getting to be quite expensive, more than I would have paid for books years ago.
Where do you find these records from that time period? Are they mainly at auction, or are there dealers like there are book dealers?
There are dealers, but most of them are going to auction these days, mail auctions. And I have a want list, runs about 6 or 7 pages. I haven't received it in the mail yet, but I just won at auction a record I've been looking for about 30 years. It's a campaign song from 1904. Billy Murray, who was the most popular tenor of the period, made 2 records for Columbia at the time. One of them was "We Want Teddy 4 More Years," which I've heard for years. And the other one is was for the Democrat, called "Goodbye Teddy, You Must March, March, March." And that one I just won at auction.
How do you play these? Do you listen to them?
Sure, I do.
What do you play them on?
Well, of course, I've got the equipment. I've got another 40 machines downstairs.
How many?
40 about.
Wow.
We're scattered around the house. But I play them often on electric equipment.
Have any of these been digitized?
Yes. They're doing that out at Santa Barbara now. And they're making them available on the internet.
What does that do to a collection?
Again, I really don't know. I think prices continue to go up, frankly. Judging from this last auction catalog, I thought. the fellow who runs this auction, his name is Kurt Nock. He lives in Texas. And he seems to know what people want. And one of the things that some people want are Vogue records. I don't know if you've seen them when you were young. It was a 78 record that came out at the end of the war, or right after the war. And the record was a regular 10-inch record, but an artist had painted some picture relative to the song. And then they put plastic on top and the bottom. And they released about, I would guess, about 100. About 100 different records. And Kurt told me that in the auction he had a complete set that sold to someone for $88,000. Some people have an awful lot of money. And furthermore, there was nothing of any importance on it. It's just that
being a complete set, was that the...
Yeah.
I heard someone say at the meeting this week that Google is at the University of Michigan digitizing every book in the library.
I've heard of that.
And he showed as an example Edgar Faust Smith's book on chemistry in America. Mm-hmm. and you can read the whole book online or print it out. Which I found fascinating, but at the same time, I have a copy of that book. But I suppose, I guess what I'm getting at is that will books disappear from libraries as everything becomes digitized? For example, at Lehigh, Science Magazine, which was bound back to issue number one, had been used so often that it was in terrible shape. Now it's all digitized. You don't need to use the hardcover binding anymore because you can get it off the computer. Transactions of the Royal Society, all of these things are now available without having to open up the hardcover. And I can see that, and the university actually took the hardcover off the shelf.
What do they do?
And put a note saying, see this, you know, on the web, see this, give the location.
But they put it in storage.
They put it in storage.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of libraries are putting less used books into storage. I know Chicago's done that for a long time. Although, normally, anything I wanted has been on the shelf.
Well, I guess I still like to hold a book in my hands.
Oh, I do too. I don't want to. I really don't like computers. And someone got into my last computer, and I have not been able to use my email since then. I bought a new computer. It makes no difference. I've got a problem with the university system, and I'm going to have to actually go down there and talk to the people. I've been trying to handle it now for a month by phone, and they've given me a new password, and it seemed to be up and running, and then suddenly I'm locked out again. That's just terrible news. If you've got a book, it'll be there all the time.
I told someone recently that when I travel, my portable means of entertainment doesn't require a battery. Well, is there anything you'd like to add that I haven't asked you? Anything you wanted to comment about?
I don't know. I suppose there are lots of books I could point to. That top shelf there, that's another case. That's the Histoire and Memoirs of the French Academy of Sciences.
Oh, my.
From the volume 1, 1699 to 1747. I wasn't sure that I was going to be working on French science, and Bob Rosenthal, who was in charge of special collections at Chicago, used to tell me when he saw things that might be of interest. He told me about this, and I thought, oh, well, it's $200. But I don't know whether I want it. So I sent him an order by C-mail, and I got it. And I've got, this is the 18-8 abstract of the Transactions of the Royal Society. So all of the all of the articles are listed. Most of them are printed completely, but not all of them.
I have some coffee and things too.
Yes.
You like some coffee?
Actually, I've never had a cup of coffee in my life.
Oh, you don't?
Better not. Okay.
And
well, I can make some tea.
Actually, the water will be fine.
Okay, well, I'll have some things to eat. To come to the...
We're just about finished, I think. If
well, unless you've got, you have anything else?
No, I don't have anything else.
All right. Well, I can go book by book on the shelves.
If you want to. Well, let me stop this at No, I won't need to take a picture now. That's excellent. Wonderful. Thank you.
You want to jot down the book it's from?
Yes. Well, I have the tape recorder back on, so we can, if you just say it, we can.
Wait a minute. Let's do it this way. Might as well do this, too.
Oh, okay.
Unless you want to take the picture also.
No, this is fine. This is.
I wish I had the first volume now.
Picture that too. Anyway, it identifies.
Yeah. Well, let me try and get a picture of the title page and.
Need more light than this?
No, you
better put it where you move. Or you want it.
The camera shut itself off because I didn't use it. Yes, I think that would. Okay. Thank you.
Now, what I wanted to show you, this is a two-volume.
2 volumes and then treatise on radioactivity. This was a discard from the University of Chicago library. Oh, there was a signature in here too. I don't see it. Anyway, that's getting into the 20th century for me. Where's the other one? There it is. What was this? Franz Devereux Corey. I'd have to know more about the family. I don't. But it looks as though it was someone in the family who had this copy. Anyway, that's my 20th century.
Okay, fascinating.
And one other thing that I didn't mention. These things keep coming to mind. This would happen to anyone. There would be more things. Where is it? Hitchcock. Ethan Allen Hitchcock on alchemy. Hitchcock was a Civil War general. He was an alchemist, the kind that is frowned upon.
Fifty-seven,
and then he wrote another book. Found in here somewhere.
That was just a little further back, I think. Yeah.
And interesting thing is that.
College of Carlisle. Is that the? Was he at the War College?
I don't know. That's Boston.
Carlisle.
And I checked with the University of Chicago Special Collections. I think this is what I'm looking for. There was a sample of his writing, which is, I think, the same handwriting here.
Yes.
Certainly it's similar.
It's very similar. So, this was his copy.
I think so.
There's a plate in the front of some kind.
Yeah, but I don't know. It doesn't have any. Well, yes, it does. Maroni. C.F. Maroni. I don't know what that is. A book dealer in Highland Park called me and offered it to me.
Well, I guess that's part of the collecting is once you get known for an interest, yeah. Dealers will, if they think you're likely to buy it, will contact you. Rather than you contacting them.
Well, it's happened to me occasionally, not very often. No.
Fascinating.
Did he take his picture?
Well, I want to get a picture of the two of you. Oh, we did. I took these. Okay. I have these. I wanted to get a picture of the two of you, and then one of you holding a book in front of the bookcases.
Get your picture first. All in the book. of some of these crops around here.
Yes, a little closer to the... That's it. That's fine. No, no, don't move the chair. That'll be all right.
Listen to me. Let me take this out of here. I'll get it.
Okay.
I wasn't coming your way, was I?
No.
Hello?
I'll take... Just keep looking at it. I'll take another one.
Oh, hi. Well, we're okay.
All right.
Okay.
Oh, I'm having what? Oh, yeah. Just a minute. I put out in here.
Hello?
Well, he does not want to.
No, it's fine.
To see the prospective ones now. Our grandmother.
Oh.
And this is. Kristen is at the Northwestern doing a certain microbiology because she's spending the cancer research.
Okay.
And they pay a lot for expenses.
Well,
she graduated summa cum laude from the University of Illinois. This is the only boy we have now.
Oh, great.
Of the three boys, we only have one. And,
what is his name?
Jonan. And this is Katie. She's
what? I think you have to do that.
And this is Ali. He's 9. And here's my star.
Well, you have to tell somebody before they do it.
Oh, this is Sarah. This is the oldest one. She graduated summa cum laude from Tulane.
Oh, it's my.
Before
I know.
Hurricane.
Before the hurricane.
And
wow.
This is such a beautiful thing. And then to see all that mess of distress.
Sure.
And she's doing the graduate work in clinical psychology.
Where?
At the University of Alabama.
Right. Okay.
And she knows Spanish, so she has clients of little children who only can speak English in family, so she's able to use the Spanish language. So that's the
beautiful family.
The future generation.
Right.
And that's
intriguing because I've interviewed mostly scientists, mm-hmm. and very few of them have children who became scientists.
Yeah.
So
the only one who's not interested in science.
Yeah, listen, Mike, I've got a call you back later.
Very creative.
A guest here.
Okay.
And language. She's right now. She's still in Japanese.
Oh my.
Okay.
I say, finally, you come back to me. But, this door is close to us. We don't see Sarah and the other ones. So Sarah is...
We'll be showing pictures of grandchildren again.
Yeah.
Beautiful family.
And this one's leaving. Well, this is the house. I don't know what it's going to be. After three boys, we have 5 girls and 1 boy.
Wow, that's interesting. That's fascinating.
Yeah, so it was nice to have the girls. And his mother always wanted to have girls.
Well, I'm sure you didn't object to having some girls either.
No, it's nice. Yeah. Especially the very attached to you. Your girls. Very attached to you. Grampy, where's Grampy? Okay, and he wants to take a picture with two of us.
Two of us?
Yeah. What's in the phone?
Mike Walton.
Mike Walton.
One of my graduate students. Former graduate students.
Yeah. Okay, where do you want us?
That's fine,
okay.
Right there.
Okay, you answer that.
No books this time?
No books this time.
Okay.
I've got books in the background.
Okay.
Let me try one more, just to make sure. Good, okay. Thank you. do appreciate your spending the afternoon with me and taking time to
show me. Here to look at.
Okay.
This is one of the flood marks. This is the same etch thing that comes in Harvey's Baymont Chorus. And Harvey was using Flood's publisher. And this is Flood with two D's again. And this is good paper for the period. But it's also Germany in the 30 Years' War period. And so one of the worst cases of drowning in the
world.
And I was working at the Newberry Library at the time, and the thing was really falling apart. I had bought it from Ernst Weil, the Einstein specialist dealer. And they rebounded at the Newberry for me. But they did every page in this plastic. Very difficult to read. But the book cost me £10 from Weil, and it cost $200 to and it's practically unreadable, I'm afraid.
But it probably wouldn't exist if you hadn't had that done. Why, if it was falling apart as badly as it looks.
I've never seen it offered for sale other than this copy. I'm sure there are copies there offered for sale, but I've never seen it. Anyway, such is life.
I also have one small matter of business, and that is a release form.
Okay.
And by the way, our oldest son is a writer too.
Oh.
Publishes on dinosaurs. And he's very, very, he makes the models too. And they are anatomically perfect. And he's also, he has some in the museums. So he's a chemist too. Environmental Protection Agency. But,
well, it's nice that you have some of them nearby, at least, because...
Yeah, I know. It's sad when, you know, because they move out and they have to go where their interests
are. Right.
But we're having a wedding in August, and it's one of our granddaughters who's getting married.
Oh.
And she's getting married on our wedding anniversary, too.
Thank you.
So we're having
a
celebration.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Alan has to learn to dance again.
Okay. Well,
I hope this didn't take too much of your time.
Oh, not at all. That's what I'm here for. I purposely didn't book a flight back till tomorrow morning anyways, because I never like to meet with someone and then say, oh, I have to rush off to the airport. And I'm too old to rush off to the airport anyways anymore. I like to take my time.
Where are you staying?
The Renaissance Hotel.
Oh, that's
over
that's
in Northbrook.
Nice. Okay,
I think it's in Northbrook. I don't know. I found it on the web and
yeah,
it
nice
looked good.
Place.
So I.
Very
I
nice
it's not far from here from what I can see. As I said, I printed out the map, so I knew about where you were, but I was concerned when the street, when the house numbers were four digits up there. And,
and then they start going lower. I think that the reason they studied, they have to number according, we have a creek, the way the creek goes or whatever. That's what they said.
Yeah, when it It's not the creek, it's the turn from north-south to
north-south to west.
And east-to-west.
Well, before I turn the tape recorder off, let me just end by saying thank you very much for spending the afternoon and
thank you for
telling me about
I enjoyed meeting you, and I rarely get a chance to talk about the books.
Well, I'm glad you did. I'm glad you took the time to talk to me about them. We will...